I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Essie Weingarten, founder of the nail polish company Essie. Essie is available in roughly 25,000 salons in more than 100 countries. Essie launched in 1981 with $10,000, and the company was bought by L'Oreal in 2010. Essie is from Hollis Hill, Queens. Welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here, Jessica.
Before we get started, I'm noticing that you are wearing some red nail polish. Can I see your hands for a second? What do you call that color?
She's pampered.
When did that color come out?
Probably about 10 years ago, but it's so apropos now since I'm not working and I'm enjoying life and I feel very pampered.
When did you get them done?
Yesterday, as a matter of fact.
How did you come up with the name She's Pampered?
It was from a collection where it was all about opulence, and this was one of six colors, and it always is about the theme. Mm-hmm. So She's Pampered just looked right to me. It was like a rosy red, and it looked like any woman could wear it when she's feeling really special.
People who know the brand Essie, who use the nail polish, they know you for your names, as well as other attributes. Names range from wicked to fancy pants, tomboy no more, rock star skinny. And I feel like these names are just on the right side of naughty. Can you talk to us about your thinking surrounding the names?
Well, I always wanted to have a personality. So if the names had a personality, women would remember them. If it's numbers, it's so impersonal. And it's like, what number is it? If they don't remember the whole name, they remember something about the name. And there's a very funny story. A woman met me and she said to me, "Oh my God, you're Essie?" I was in a salon and this woman asked for dancing shoes. And I said, "That's not one of my colors." And she said, no, I know it's one of your colors." I said, "I don't have anything called dancing shoes." To make a long story short, she was talking about ballet slippers. And I said, "Oh, got it. Okay, ballet slippers," when we went through the whole thing, which, you know, everyone talks about ballet slippers when they're talking about a delicious pink color. And to me, it was my days of Miss Lee at ballet school. And everyone else wore black leotards, and I wore pink leotards. So it was always that childhood memory of me being feminine and special. And when the Queen of England wanted the Essie ballet slippers, I received a letter with the royal crest. And it was HRH, and it was the hairdresser of the Queen of England. And basically, he asked if I would sell them the polish, and I said, "Of course." He wanted to know if I could ship it immediately, and I said, "I'll hand deliver it." I mean, I thought I arrived at the moon.
So Queen Elizabeth wears ballet slippers. Wouldn't it be funny if she wore like bikini sotini?
I would love it. I think it would be so chic on her toes.
Speaking of Queen Elizabeth, there was another woman in the early days who really kind of helped you become. And I'm thinking of Joan Rivers.
Oh,
were you
Jelly
thinking of
Apple.
Joan Rivers?
Yes. Joan was very special. She was on Johnny Carson. She was basically, I think she was sidekick that night, and Johnny asked her what she was wearing. And she said, on the Tonight Show, "I'm wearing Jelly Apple by Essie." And I did get to thank her before she died in person. And I mean, that was a very special day in my life.
Where were you? Were you watching the show coincidentally?
Yes, I was. I mean, I was a Johnny Carson fanatic, so I didn't miss a show. If I was home, I saw it.
And this was in 1983?
It was probably 81 or two.
So you didn't know this was coming to you. Can you describe that moment? Were you by yourself sitting on your couch? Or
I was in bed listening to Joan Rivers and Johnny, and all of a sudden it was like, did I hear right? And you pinch yourself. They're talking about my baby.
Did you get phone calls that night? Do you remember?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, lots of calls. And by the next morning, it was like everyone was talking about it.
And by the way, this is before social media, and this is before you're able to watch the show again and again on YouTube. You were lucky to have seen it. Otherwise, you would have just heard about it.
Absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. How the world has changed.
Right. So I want to go back to 1981 when you decided to launch Essie with $10,000. How did you muster the $10,000? Where did that come from?
I was working. I worked at Henri Bendel for a couple of years. I was going to FIT in the evening. And then after Bendel's, I went to work for a ladies' hosiery company that was owned by two brothers, and they did private label pantyhose.
Do you remember, like, the moment when you went in and you told your boss, you know what, I'm doing this company, I'm off on my own?
Yeah, I do. I said I was leaving, and he was not happy, and basically said, we're not going to give you the 10-year pin. And I went, well, I'll have to live without it. And I moved on. When you are ready to go, you got to go.
I love that you didn't get your 10-year pin.
No.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Essie Weingarten, founder of Essie, a nail polish company with more than 300 colors. The company was bought in 2010 by L'Oreal. What other ideas did you have for starting a business other than nail polish, or did you have a maniacal focus on?
I was pretty focused that there was no one doing colors that were great, a formula that would be looking wet for a whole week, and if I found the chemist to do it. And all major chemical companies and cosmetic companies were looking at the big picture. They were looking at foundations, where the money is. Nails, the money wasn't in nails. Mm-hmm. I mean, in 1981, there were only two big companies doing nail polish. And I just thought that, you know, it made me feel special if women started getting their nails done, because in 1981, women who had their nails done were very wealthy. It wasn't a luxury that we have today where everyone can have their nails done, the affordable luxury. So I went looking for a chemist, and that was a whole year of really getting ready. When I found the right chemist, and he gave me a few formulas, and I tested them out, and I found the formula that I loved, then I had to give him colors, and I was saving ribbons and pin cushions. And from all my travels, I saved colors that really spoke to me. Incredible colors that were sharp and clean, and clean was very important. I didn't, at that particular point, there were no muddy colors in my life. And he had to match the colors. And I know you're going to laugh, but I started with 12 colors. Mm-hmm. I mean, you try to start a line today with 12 colors, people would just turn their back on you. Mm-hmm. But it was such a different world. And I was a pioneer. I changed the way women think of nail color. It became a fashion accessory that if your nails are not polished, you're not dressed.
Right. And as you're talking to me, I'm curling my nails into my shirt so you don't see that I'm not wearing nail polish.
Well, you're half-dressed.
So you found this chemist who really, you know, helped you get everything off the ground. What was his or her name, and where was...
He was in New Jersey, and his name was Stanley. He's no longer with us, unfortunately, but he was a very big part of my success. I mean, I've always had an amazing team around me. He just listened.
So you launched with these 12 colors, and what did the names range from?
Well, some of them are still in the line. Bordeaux, which is like a very good bottle of red wine. It's a deep, delicious burgundy color. And Blanc and Baby's Breath. Blanc is that true chalk white, and Baby's Breath was a softer white for a French tip of a French manicure, which was a very big part of our beginning.
Very popular in the early 80s.
Yes.
So you launched, and you decided to go to Las Vegas when you launched because the women in casinos, you know, they had hands that everyone saw. And also it was a meeting place of sorts for women from all the coasts who traveled there. Can you talk about what you did in Las Vegas?
Yeah. I mean, it was very important to me that I'd go to a place where I get the best bang for my buck. And I thought Las Vegas in 81, between showgirls, dealers, dancers that were always in the public eye, that always had to have beautiful hands and beautiful feet. If I could get them to try the Essie polish, wow. Once you try it, you're hooked. It's the best addiction around. And it did work. I just left samples at every beauty salon, and there were less than 100 in 1981. And every hotel spa. I left them a little plastic bag with 12 colors and 3 treatments. And I said, call me if you like it. Within 2 weeks, every single one of them called and placed an order. And I was like, yes, I have a business.
You were in your early 30s at the time. Do you remember even that trip to Las Vegas with all of this nail polish in your bag?
Absolutely. It was like yesterday. We went to Kennedy Airport because it was a nonstop flight, and you were allowed to take whatever you wanted on the plane. I mean, I must have had 10 cartons weighing 64 pounds each. There was not a problem. Yeah. If you had 10 suitcases, they took 10 suitcases.
So you got this approval from Las Vegas immediately, but you also walked the streets of New York City, which is your hometown. Can you tell us about what that looked like?
Absolutely. I was very organized. So if I started on 96th Street, I did 96th, 95th, 94th, 93rd, from York to 5th. Then I took 86th Street and went down from there. Then I did the West Side. I mean, years ago, there weren't nail salons in every corner. I know you can't believe it. There were beauty salons.
And beauty parlors.
Beauty parlors, exactly. Mm-hmm. Some of the salons listed in the Yellow Pages. I didn't have a cell phone. Can you imagine? And you'd go up, and they were like really not salons. And you would run down the stairs because
what
there wasn't
they?
Even elevators in the building.
What were they, if not?
It was something like, lady, what are you doing here? And I said, I don't think I belong here. Let me leave.
They were a different type of salon.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Did you have problems with making enough to fit the demand in the early days?
Well, the truth of the matter is, when I first started, I didn't think I'd ever be able to sell all the bottles that I had to because it was a minimum of gallons that you had to buy. And I'll never forget, they said to me, the minimum order is 55 gallons. And I went, and how many bottles do I get from 1 gallon? 1 gallon is 200 bottles. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. How am I going to sell one color and,
10,000 bottles, roughly. Mm-hmm,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was like, not a problem, because if the color's right and the quality is right, it's a give me. Everyone wants it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Essie Weingarten, founder of the nail polish company Essie. We'll hear more from Essie coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Essie Weingarten, founder of the nail polish company Essie. Essie is available in roughly 25,000 salons in more than 100 countries. Essie launched in 1981 with $10,000, and the company was bought by L'Oreal in 2010. The names that you come up with really are autobiographical in a way. They come from some fragment of your life. Can you give examples?
I mean, we have such funny stories. We were doing a trade show in Mexico City, and we went to hail a cab. And we saw the traffic wasn't moving. So we said, never mind. Now, in Mexico City, the taxis are little Volkswagen Bugs. And the taxi drivers wear white gloves, and they open the door with, like, this little handle thing. And I went, never mind, never mind. And he yells out, you sand of a beach. It was like he was practicing this curse, and he knew I was American, and he... Well, needless to say, I had to come up with a color called Sand of the Beach. But, you know, we were in Paris July 4th, and I fell on my behind. It was pouring rain. We were going to Café Fouquet. So I came up with a color right after that very quickly called Café Fougat, because I never want to forget Café Fouquet. When we were looking for a home in the Hamptons. So I came out with a collection, and the colors were like... very important because it was south of the highway or Montauk the End or Dune Road or Picket Fence. It was something to do with the beach. And everyone said to me, oh, but the Hamptons, who's going to know about the Hamptons? Only people in New York. Well, it turned out that everyone in Europe wanted the Hampton collection. Everyone in Asia wanted the Hampton collection. Everyone in the Middle East wanted the Hampton collection. So it was just, I have to have the Hampton collection because everyone wants a piece of the Hamptons.
Going back to the early days of getting interest from New York salons, do you have any recollections of one or two beauty parlors that really helped to escalate sales for you?
Or? Absolutely. There was a place called Nail Nook on 2nd Avenue. It's no longer there. And 75th Street. And then Ruzica de Felica. We had Josephine Allen, who was on top of Yellow Fingers, and now she's at Essie Flagship Salon on 65th between Madison and Park.
For the first few years, you had a different bottle. Now there's this iconic bottle that's square-shaped, and it has your name, Essie. Your real name was Esther, but you were never called that, down the side. How did you decide to make that shift?
Well, when I first started and I went to the glass company, I said I wanted my own mold. And he said to me, well, to have your own mold, you have to sell at least 2 million bottles a year. And I went, oh my God, how am I going to do that? Well, shortly thereafter, within the first 4 years, I was able to do it with no problem, 2 consecutive years. And the bottle manufacturer said to me, if you really want to do your own mold, we can do it. And I said, it's really important to me. I needed something that would be very comfortable in the manicurist's hand because she's holding the bottle all day. I always like very angular things. I like straight lines. I'm not about roundness. And I came up with this bottle, which is round on the inside but square on the outside, and all the edges are soft round. So it fits right into the nail tech's hand, and the weight is evenly distributed.
Now, the anatomy of a bottle is, as you described, the bottle itself, but there's also the brush, and there's a little metallic, is it a steel ball inside?
2 stainless steel mixing balls. If you have one, it doesn't do anything. You need the friction of the 2 balls hitting each other, and that's just to keep everything blended. So you just roll it in your hands. You don't shake it because the 2 mixing balls can break through the glass. So you roll it and you keep the polish nice and fresh.
And the brush, is there anything special about the hairs or anything?
Absolutely. Our brushes were custom made for us. All the brushes had 199 hairs, and we always kept the brushes very thin so you can get into the corners. So you have a nice, neat manicure.
You grew up in Hollis Hills, Queens, and your father ran a party rental business, and he died when you were 16, and then your mom took over the business.
Correct. He died a week before my 16th birthday.
How did he die?
Pancreatic cancer. And my mother never worked a day in her life. She was, you know, life was on a silver platter.
So your mom was left with her 5 children and started running this business. Did you help out in the business at all?
Of course. I still do.
What was done? Like, so you rented chairs and tables and balloons and
everything for a party.
It's still in your family?
Yes, it is.
Who runs it now?
Party Time. My mom and my sisters, 2 sisters are full-time and, yep.
Out of Queens?
Yes, Queens Boulevard in Elmhurst.
Your mom was the one who took you, by the way, to your manicures, starting when you were like 6 years old. If you were a good girl in ballet, she would take you to get your nails done.
Absolutely. And that was the only time I sat still. And I sat for 1 hour blowing them dry because there was no such thing as quickie drops or anything like that. You had to sit or else you smudged and you had a mess. So I wanted them to be perfect. So I sat there.
There were not many colors to choose from, at the time. What companies did you use? Do you even remember as a 6-year-old?
I do remember. There were only 2. One was Revlon, and the other was L'Oreal. And that's the joke of the whole story. And there I am, 29 years later, selling my baby to L'Oreal.
Your father also was complicit in this nail polish love affair of yours. He would take you to an apothecary owned by his brother,
owned by a cousin, Uncle Ralph,
to pick out even more colors.
Absolutely. Do you know where the MAC store is on 5th Avenue and 59th Street?
Mm.
There used to be a hotel called the Savoy Plaza Hotel, and that's where Uncle Ralph had his apothecary. Mm-hmm. And we'd go visit Uncle Ralph on Sunday after the Lower East Side, and my dad would let me pick out colors that I would hold in my hand as my conscience for that whole week.
I want to talk about partnerships, the most important of which was with your husband, Max Sortino, who was the CEO for a while.
Yes.
Before you sold the company to L'Oreal. How did you meet Max?
Met Max in California at a trade show. He wanted to buy the only publication that was available at that time, which was called Mainly Manicuring. And instead of purchasing Mainly Manicuring, he met Essie. And he was really originally from Rome, Italy, and living in California.
And at the time, he was in business with his ex-wife selling jewelry for the nails.
Correct. You know, everyone said, oh, Essie, you need a European man. They're the only ones that'll understand a woman in business. Mm. And it was just a great fit.
And at what point did he join you in the business? Was that a no-brainer or did that take some...
Once he moved to New York, he joined me. And Max was always the visionary. I didn't have the name in the glass. Mm-hmm. I just felt that every salon loved the polish and they would put their own label on it. And he said, who's putting their label on it?
So it was his idea to put Essie on the bottle.
Absolutely. Another good idea. Not all of them, but most of them.
What were some ungood ideas?
Oh, well, everyone wanted a lipstick to match the nail polish. And, you know, everyone would ask you for it. And it is a great idea. But there are no makeup artists in the salons telling the woman, try this color. Mm. It looks great on you. It just sits there collecting dust.
So how long did you dabble in lipstick?
Probably about 5 years. We didn't give up right away. You know, the truth of the matter is, Essie was born about colors. I mean, that's what I'm known for. Colors on my life.
What does your apartment look like? Is it colorful?
No, it's not, as a matter of fact, because I was always working in color. So the apartment is very much white and dark brown. Lots of woods, different textures. Very simple, because everything else is what I do every single day of my life.
What other mistakes?
Oh, plenty of mistakes. Make mistakes, we would have never grown. Oh, we came out with a second line. That was a mistake.
What's the second line?
It was called Max. And then we had to change the name to Club Max because one of our competitors went to P&G's and said we were trading under the name of Max Factor, which it was not Max Factor. It was my husband, Max.
P&G, Procter & Gamble,
yeah,
right?
P&G. Yeah, P&G.
Did you ever have other investors? Aside?
Never.
So it was all run by your sales, all the capital that you
That's
got
it.
From your sales.
And, of course, my mother said to me, you know, you have a year and you'll see what happens. And she said, if it doesn't work, it wouldn't be a Shondo, which is a shame. And that's all I had to hear. I said, you'll wait and see. There'll be no shame here.
Your mom, was she helpful in the business?
Of course. She even came to trade shows. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's amazing. I mean, she's the rock. She really gave us very good values, and we all had to work. And she never takes no for an answer. You know, we've learned that from her. And
were you brought up in a religious household?
Well, we had two sets of dishes. We had a kosher home.
So you were Jewish and kosher.
But lots of times that we mixed up the silverware and it was like, oh my God, you have to put it in the dirt outside. Our friends would say, oh, you have flowers and silverware growing in your garden? So, you know, fun things, always fun.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Essie Weingarten, founder of Essie, a nail polish company with more than 300 colors. Essie is available in roughly 25,000 salons in over 100 countries. You mentioned that one of the two nail polish companies that sold nail polish when you were your 6 and 7 year old self, you know, getting a manicure, was L'Oreal. And little did you know that you would sell the company. Sell Essie to L'Oreal, you know, in 2010. You had an initial flirtation with L'Oreal in 2005 when they came to you and was interested in an acquisition. Can you talk about the 2005 conversation?
Well, I got a phone call in the office and the switchboard operator said, there's a call from L'Oreal. Well, everyone in the office, like their ears perked up. They really wanted to buy the company and we were not big enough, number one, and number two, we didn't want to sell the company. There's no reason to sell the company. We said goodbye, and they said they'd never come back.
That was in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to 2010, and L'Oreal approaches you again. Why were things different this time?
Well, we were growing like crazy. I mean, when the economy started to tank in 2008, our business was on fire. At that point, in 2007... business was really good, and we started with an architect. We were going to be adding onto our building. We were expanding the parking lot, and we were going up. And then as the economy started to get funky in 2008, I put the stop sign up, and I said, let's wait and see what's going to happen. Instead, our business just kept on growing double digits, and we were busting at the seams. Of course, he was right, and we should have built. It was 2009, Christmas, when I got a phone call wishing us a Merry Christmas, and I said, they're back, because they said they would never come back. And after that phone call, we didn't hear from them again till I think it was the end of February. And when they called again, they said they want a deal and they want it quick. They were afraid that I was going to back out of the deal, which I could have done very easily. But, you know, if I make a commitment, my word's my bond and I stick by it.
So, but why did you sell?
Because we were busting by the seams. I mean, we really were working like three shifts around the clock. We had no more room.
Mm-hmm. It was, so you needed capital to expand? Or?
No, we have the capital. We just needed, you needed location. Mm-hmm. Number one, I mean, we were very aggressive with inventory, always were, always had containers on the ocean coming in from Italy constantly, mm-hmm. always was aggressive with chemicals. I mean, lots of pails, I was never out of stock and everyone knew it. You wanted something, you never had to wait for it. And that was, you know, that was part of the magic formula. California, they got it in a week. New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, they had it the next day and everyone knew it. Yeah. I spoiled my customers rotten and I loved every minute of it.
Essie is available in over 100 countries, and the first country was Japan.
We were in over 100, we thought 109 when we sold the company, and then they came back to us after the due diligence and said, you didn't tell us the truth, you're in 114 countries.
Do you notice anything culturally different between like what Americans want on their nails versus a woman in Jordan? Do you even sell in Jordan, for example?
Yes, we do, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. The truth of the matter is, when we were in Kuwait, which was quite interesting, there were women praying, and the cultural difference was before they pray, they have their polish removed. And after they're done praying, they get their nails done again. So it's a really great market. And I thought that was something so interesting. And in Dubai, of course, it's completely different. But we were doing a shoot for a magazine, and there was this woman wearing a burqa. And I said, would you like to be in the article? And she said she would. And she took off her burqa, and I never saw anything so beautiful in my whole life. She was a banker. And she said, if my husband sees this, he'll kill me. And I thought I would die. I mean, and this is like only 2008 or 9.
This is in Dubai?
In Dubai. You're saying, wow, the world has moved so fast. And then you find these little clusters where women are still living in the past.
Where do you get your nails done?
I get my nails done at Samuel Shariki on 65th Street.
When you do get manicures at other places, when the people don't know you, do you tell them that you are Essie?
No, of course not. My little stepson would always say, you know who she is? And I would say, Ben, don't do that.
Ben comes with you to get your nails done sometimes?
Oh, Ben would be there, yeah. They
there
get
ever?
Very nervous, I will tell you. When they find out, they get extremely nervous. I don't know why, but they do.
Was there ever a time they didn't believe you, that you were indeed Essie?
Well, you know, sometimes I'd go into a salon and it wasn't even to get a manicure, just to be selling product. And I would say, hi, I'm Essie. And they would say, Manny. And I said, no, I'm Essie. Hello, I just want to, you know, introduce myself. And they get a little bit confused. Mm-hmm. But it was always fun. Yeah. And, you know, the business card always worked.
Right. Now, the market has changed a bit. I mean, it used to be basically exclusively women, and now more and more men are going into salons, and male grooming is, you know, increasing in importance to men. Do you know many men who get their nails polished?
Absolutely. A lot of them will get one color of either one coat of Mademoiselle, which my husband happens to wear, because it just looks like a good finish, almost like a woman's blush. So it's a little bit of something, but it's no one could tell it's a color. And then some men are really getting color. In LA, you'll see men wearing a lot of sandals, flip-flops, and they have pedicures, and they're wearing color. And the first time I saw it was Seal, and he was wearing Dominica Green.
Seal, the singer.
And then he was wearing Aruba Blue, and I went like, Heidi, yes! Mm-hmm. You know, and I've been really fortunate from A to Z. And when I say A to Z, all these celebrities from Angelica Houston to Renee Zellweger, they all wore Essie, and they would share it and tell you these stories. And I never did any celebrity endorsements. They wore it. They spoke about it because they loved it. And I mean, how lucky can a woman be?
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Jessica. Thank you.
My guest has been Essie Weingarten, founder of Essie. Coming up, we'll meet Sam Goldman, co-founder of Delight. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Sam Goldman, co-founder of Delight, a company that sells affordable solar lighting and power to consumers in developing countries. Roughly 20% of the world population does not have access to reliable electricity. Delight is focused on providing cleaner, cheaper, safer lighting and energy in over 60 countries. Sam started Delight in 2007 with Ned Tozin, whom he met at Stanford Business School. Prior to starting Delight, Sam served in the Peace Corps in Benin, West Africa. Welcome.
Thank you.
Your first foray into the developing world was not in the Peace Corps after college. You grew up with a family who caused you to live in several places. Your mother, for example, was focused on maternal health, right?
Yes.
And your father on agriculture. What are some memories you have of that?
Well, a lot of them, especially when I was growing up, were some of the amazing vacations we took, actually. So, you know, flying into a drug trafficking strip in the Amazon rainforest. You have to take a boat up the Amazon for 3-4 hours, and it's just surrounded by, you know, animals howling at night. Things like that, which were, you know, pretty unusual and very sticky in the child's mind.
What are some impressions of, you know, what your mother did, for instance, that stuck with you outside these exotic vacations?
Right. Well, I just remember, especially in India, she got a plaque saying, you know, thanking her for making a contribution to the lives of 10 million women and children in India. And it was sort of like, oh my gosh, my mom's doing this really interesting work. And she wasn't trying to make huge technological shifts. She was trying to make sure that women understood that they should breastfeed.
How was the experience of the Peace Corps different from what you expected, since you had tangentially been in this world previously?
That's a good question. There's no substitute for actually doing it and living it yourself. You can read about it, you can watch movies about it, you can theoreticize about it. But when you go out and actually do it, and you live there and you feel the seasons and you eat the same food everybody else does, and you go and you work in the fields and see how long and how much effort it takes to grow yams and then to turn them into a food, and how unreliable your source of income is when you're dependent on the weather and the crops and food prices globally. All these little things that after a while you start to really understand what is important to people.
And it was in the Peace Corps where you had your first experience with kerosene lamps, where you discovered how ineffective and dangerous they are, and that had a deep impact on you. What was your exposure to kerosene lamps firsthand?
And when you're in the Peace Corps, in many countries, certainly in West Africa, you're issued by the government a kerosene lantern. And so I used that for my 3.5 years of Peace Corps service. Mm. And you don't want to use it. And really the game-changing experience for me was when a friend had bought from Walmart or Kmart or somewhere an LED headlamp, and they left the country and I got their headlamp. And so I just switched over and started wearing this headlamp at night, and all of a sudden I could see things and I could cook inside, and I wanted to read because it was more pleasant and I didn't feel sort of lightheaded when I was reading under the lamp. And that's when I started like writing LED companies and saying, hey, here's this unmet market need. Can I distribute for you? We got to make this happen. And
just with these LED lamps.
Just with simple battery powered LED lamps, and saying, well, like, why isn't this? Why is there's a total market failure? Why isn't this happening? And literally not one person responded to an email or a letter.
So when did the idea for a solar lamp arrive?
The thing that really tipped me over the edge, my next door neighbor, he was a 15-year-old boy at the time, he had a kerosene fire accident, and he almost died, and he got third-degree burns all over his body. But he survived, and he's fine now. But that got me researching. I found out that like a million people a year die from kerosene fires. Once it starts, it spreads all over the place. It causes a lot of harm. So people they're scared of kerosene. They're spending a lot of money on it. It's unhealthy for them. And it's really a terrible source of light. It doesn't, mm-hmm. it's not actually very bright. Solar is magical. It's you put it outside and it just delivers you free power. And this notion that you're not going to be dependent on somebody else to charge and you don't have to walk or drive to a charging station and you won't have this constant outlay of cash, it totally changes the game. They've never had independent power, control over their power independently before.
So you had this grievance with kerosene lamps kind of in your back pocket, mm-hmm. as you made your way to Stanford Business School. How does a biologist and a Peace Corps enthusiast decide to go to business school?
I wasn't planning to go to business school. When I was in Peace Corps, essentially, I was an anti-capitalist. I was this biologist, environmentalist. I had ridden my bike across Canada, kind of doing this climate change route. I was doing all these things. And then when I got to Benin, I realized the only thing that was really, really changing the country and changing it quickly was business. Not none of, but a lot of the NGOs and the public sector activities I was seeing in my distant village of 2,000 people, they just weren't having the same impact. So I decided I wanted to go become a social entrepreneur and applied only to the schools that were really on the vanguard of that. And Stanford was one of them.
So I was told that you used to have a beard, you used to wear a lot of necklaces. What right. did Sam look like 10 years ago?
Gosh. Well, so I didn't have any money. And I didn't have anybody I had to impress for any reasons. So, you know, I wore a lot of the local garb. So very long, flowy clothes. My best friend in my village was a tailor. You know, it could be a living room. It could be patterns of a living room all over my body, or like I don't know, like bananas, or like it was really sort of fun. You know, if you've seen West African clothes, they're beautiful and they're gorgeous and they're creative. And a big beard and sometimes colored hair and. Yeah, I was having fun.
This is your Peace Corps years?
These are my Peace Corps years.
So comes Stanford Business School. How long did that last?
You drive up that palm-lined boulevard and you know, every leaf that falls off a tree gets somehow miraculously swept up by someone somewhere. It's hard to be quite so. And you don't realize, you just, we're humans, right? We adapt to our circumstances. So when I was in a village, there's no washing machine anywhere. You do it by hand. Nothing ever gets clean. And so that was just the way I kind of was. But then once I'd shifted focus, I kind of cleaned up my act.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Goldman, co-founder of D-Light, a company that produces solar lighting and energy products to consumers at the bottom of the pyramid in developing countries, where one out of three people does not have access to reliable energy. The idea and prototypes for D-Light grew out of a class that Sam took at Stanford Business School with co-founder Ned Tozum, called Design for Extreme Affordability. Now, I say it was out of the business school, but it was really out of the Stanford Design School, where pioneer David Kelly, he founded this program. Can you talk to me about how the idea went from just that to something more concrete in that space?
Yeah, absolutely. The design school was almost a startup within Stanford. The first semester was essentially learning how to do design and human-centered design the way IDEO kind of teaches it with all sorts of mini projects. And then the second semester was we had a client, a customer, which was an NGO based in Myanmar, and we had to go and actually produce something valuable for them that they could take to market. And they worked in the water space predominantly. And for whatever reason, there was a small group of us who we just weren't as excited about doing something in the water space, and we really wanted to do energy. And I personally was pushing a lot for doing something in energy because I had been in Peace Corps, and I had lived for a couple of years with a kerosene lantern, and I knew that there were better options. And so I knew that was true also in Myanmar. And so we kind of coalesced and talked to this NGO about whether we could go and would they be interested if we could come up with a better source of lighting than what the typical population in Myanmar would have. If we could design something, would they be interested in taking it to market? And they said, yes, that would be a good project. Let's do it.
What did you discover in Myanmar specifically because of the totalitarian government?
I mean, the country used to be a source where people would go to Myanmar for higher education. All over South Asia was recognized there was actually somewhat of a grid that went out to these villages and there was electricity, and it's all fallen apart. They didn't even have kerosene, which is sort of the worst form of lighting for most people in the world, but kerosene was banned. So people would burn diesel as their only source of light if they could get it. Or if you didn't want to burn diesel, which is, you can imagine, pretty noxious way to live your life, you would pony up for very expensive tiny little candles that would burn quickly. And then if you had a little more money and wanted to splurge, you could buy these really noxious lead acid batteries, which would run for like a day or two, and they would charge them up on these massive, like, I don't know, 1920, 1930s generators. And they would tell us, like, oh, yeah, you know that the batteries are being charged well if the acid is boiling. The whole thing was so amazingly wrong and backwards that it really... it blew our minds. And I think some of the stories were what allowed us, I think, ultimately to get some of the venture funding we got in the Valley.
What are some of those stories?
You know, we participated in this one thing called the DFJ Venture Challenge.
DFJ being Draper Fisher, a leading venture firm in the Valley.
Venture firm. And what they do is they take all the winners at the various business school competitions and they pit them all up against each other in this one DFJ Venture Challenge. We went in to just sort of tell the human story. And the story we told was about a woman named Mia. And we had gone to her village and left them some very early prototypes. Look nothing like what we have now. It was a large family, and they would essentially get up at like 10 p.m., go out, dig up the earth, and work all night making these mud bricks, which they sold for half a penny each later. And they would have to work all night and then get done in the morning and leave them out so that during the day they would get baked by the sun and then they could sell the bricks. And so these lights completely changed their lives. But she literally started crying when we said, you know, we have to take these prototypes back. They're not going to work long term. This is just something we put together. This is like one lady out of 2 billion, and this is going to matter, and it's going to matter a lot.
What did the initial prototypes out of the D School look like?
Yeah, there were. I mean, and obviously the D School methodology is get it done and get it done fast and learn as quickly as you can, right? So, I mean, you'd slap a battery into a box and run a naked wire off it to a little circuit board with some LEDs soldered to it. I mean, it was not a consumer product in any way, shape, or form. And we just wanted to experiment with how much power, how much light is enough, what are kind of the price points that we need to hit to make this viable. And then also, does it have to be solar? Can it be a combination of, you know, just fast charging technology or batteries or not?
Distribution was harder for you than you had expected. Can you talk to me about what that landscape is? Because that's really the gating factor in a way.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We don't realize that the average base of the pyramid family or individual is not a consumer. A lot of them are subsistence farmers. They grow their own food. They buy just a few essentials that they absolutely need. They are used to word of mouth, and they're used to testimonials that come from people they trust, not from companies that come from some other land.
Right.
And that is the hard and expensive part, is to get out and actually build a new category that did not exist even a couple of years ago.
Can you give some examples of just firsthand experience that you had in educating?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, we were at this award ceremony yesterday, and one of the speakers who came and we're honored to have him was the CEO of SKS Microfinance, which is one of the world's largest microfinance institutes. And we have partnered with them. And we originally started, and I did in 2008 when I went to India, because microfinance loan officers are actually going out into the deepest communities, and, you know, groups of women come once a week and meet together, and they distribute loans of $200 or less to these women. But it's an opportunity to say, here's a new technology, and it's coming from somebody they trust, who they know and have known for many weeks, and to say, here it is, here's how it works. If you'd be interested, we'd be able to offer it to you on some kind of financing so that it doesn't become a burden, and they can go and try it and experience it. And that's an example of a distribution channel, which has been very, very powerful for us and a very good partner.
Another partner for you is the French company Total. Who are they?
Absolutely. So that's another, you know, a really interesting one that you wouldn't immediately think about. But, you know, Total has an interest in being an energy company, not just in being an oil company, even though I don't know exactly their revenue split. But they have retails, almost like mini marts, gas stations all over the world. And they have a very high concentration of them in Africa and South Asia also. And so we've partnered with them to be able to put our lights into their stations, which is a trusted, well-known place that people can go to if they want to buy the technology.
The price of your technologies range from, is it $7 to $40, depending upon what you're selling? Is that?
It really ranges from probably around $8 to $10 on the low end, up to just south of $200 for a solar home system with multiple lights and, you know, running a radio and charging cell phones and doing other things.
Do you remember your first customers?
Yeah, we had first customers. I mean, we had sold things before we moved overseas. We were working out of a garage in Mountain View. I mean, we were kind of the typical startup. And I remember we had sold things before we even had products. So I had sold into, I think it was the Infosys Foundation in India. And when I think about it now, it's ridiculous, right? We hadn't finished making the product. We certainly hadn't shipped it. And when we did try to ship it, this is before, like, we didn't know any of the details of international business. You have to get all these permits. And you can't just bring a product into a country, and we didn't have the VAT certificate, all this stuff. So it was a pretty steep learning curve. I would be really excited to redo another business at some point where I don't have to go through all these learnings and can just get it right the first time.
We're talking a little bit at 10,000 feet on the impact that these lights and these products have had. Can you talk to me on a more granular level on how you've changed these people's lives?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, this was in Uttar Pradesh in India, which is one of the largest states. And we were coming back and talking to a farmer at night, and he was saying, oh, and he was using Hindi, and I don't know the exact phrase, but he was essentially saying, thank you. D-Light is almost like a god. It's, you know, thank you so much for having brought this. I was coming back, and a snake almost bit me, but I saw the snake because I have your light. And then proceeded to tell us all these stories of other people who'd been bitten by snakes and leading to, you know, often fatal accidents.
I heard that you were bit by a snake at some point and you had a kerosene lamp.
Right? Yeah, I did. I did actually during Peace Corps walk in. I was, because you know, with a kerosene lamp, you can't really see anything. So I did walk into my house once and got bitten by a snake, dropped the lantern, it smashed. I'm sitting in the dark. I know I've been bitten. And it turned into quite an adventure because my health center didn't have any vaccines. And a friend of mine, like, put me on the back of his motorcycle, drove me 7 kilometers. I get to this health center, and the guy says, oh, great, yeah, I actually have the serum for you. And you're really lucky because somebody came in last week for it, but they couldn't afford it, so I couldn't give it to them. Huh. It's like, oh, gosh.
You've spent the majority of your time in the developing world. You're living in Vancouver now in Canada, but you were living in India prior. How long were you in India after business school and getting this off the ground?
After business school, I moved to India. My co-founder moved to Shenzhen, China. And essentially, I started up the sales and marketing. I was running product development. He was doing more operations and finance part of the company. And so I was in India for a couple of years. But I'd actually done my high school there. So I had some familiarity and knew some people in India. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Hong Kong and opened the office there as we started to expand more internationally. And now I live in Vancouver because my wife, I'm half Canadian. My wife's also Canadian. And
speaking of your wife, I was wondering what your kind of private social life was like. You know, because you've had a nomadic existence, and then I saw you walk into the office here with your wife Rosie, who is pregnant. It's nice to see that part of your life was able to be enriched simultaneous with you know, your professional one. How did you meet your wife? How did you meet Rosie?
We met originally, I met Rosie in undergraduate, and we were together, and there was something just magical about the way we were, but school ended, we both went our separate ways and sort of kept in touch with each other maybe once every 5 years or so, but a group of friends from undergraduate, we do kayaking trips every once in a while. Now we've turned it into a habit in British Columbia and Canada, and so we saw each other 1 year, and the next thing I know, she was coming over to Hong Kong on a one-way ticket, and things went from there.
What do your parents make of all this?
Oh, of course, they're ridiculously excited and proud of all the work that we're doing. And it's so much an extension of what they had done beforehand. Just opening up their, you know, they had very good personal relationships with people all over the world, whether it was in India with the business or health communities, or whether it was in Rwanda with the, you know, government communities, and just being able to link me back into those families and individuals. Because in the end, whether it's business or whether it's development work, it's all personal.
So they had a vast Rolodex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Isn't it interesting how we use the term Rolodex now? You've spent your life shifting back and forth between developing countries and, you know, Canada or the United States. What do you find most striking when you return to, let's say, Vancouver?
How lucky we are. Yeah, the world's not fair, the work that people have to do for a couple dollars a day.
Even in your daily life, like, what do you find striking?
Well, landing, you know, you land in Vancouver if you're coming from Beijing or you're coming from New Delhi, and it's like you have to squint because it's so bright and the sun, like the sun's just blaring and it's so clean and pure and the air is so, you know, it's a like little thing. The air is so pure. Like, where else do I get this kind of air that I can breathe, which you'd think everybody would get? And it's so silent. The streets are more or less empty. Nobody's bothering me, and I can go home to my house where I can drink the water out of the tap. And it's just all these really kind of banal stuff, which we take totally for granted, but everything works.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Sam Goldman, co-founder of Delight. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.